The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is part two of the History of Globalization, presented by Professor Amory Starr. It was recorded on May 19th of 2005 in Venice, California. Amory Starr is an activist, sociologist, and documentary filmmaker. Her first book was Naming the Enemy, Anti-Corporate Movements Confront Globalization, published by Zed Books in the year of 2000. It was the first systematic documentation of the emergence of the alter-globalization movement, which she actually wrote before the events of Seattle. Her second book, Global Revolt, also from Zed Books, is a beginner's guidebook to the movement. Contact information is given at the end of both recordings.
So the third historical phase of globalization is the era of free trade. And when we were in Seattle, on the eve of the Battle of Seattle, Vandana Shiva said, "Globalization has tried three times. The first try was colonialism, and it lasted 500 years. The second try was development, and it lasted 50 years. Now they're trying free trade, and it only lasted 5 years." We were all very excited about that. In 1944, along with the IMF and the World Bank, a third global financial institution was created called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT. This agreement, sort of like a treaty, was renegotiated many times since 1944, and it was basically voluntary. It didn't really have any enforcement powers, and it was agreement about trade and international trade in major goods. In 1994, after a seven-year round of negotiation, the GATT was transformed into the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and this took effect in January of 1995. Now, the WTO is one of many free trade agreements, or FTAs. The main difference between it and the others is that it's the most international. It has the most members. The WTO has about 144 members now, whereas NAFTA, the North American FTA, just covers trade between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. The AGOA is a relationship between the U.S. and most of sub-Saharan Africa. APEC covers much of the Far East, Russia, the Pacific, Peru, Mexico, the U.S., and Canada. Sort of a weird region there. But the basic logic of all the FTAs and the WTO is the same. The promises of free trade agreements and of the WTO are really not modified much from the promises of the modernization development system. The idea is that increasing trade and export will hasten growth. Growth will increase incomes and facilitate peace. That's the basic argument that they use, and that's the core of what they promote to justify the system. They do have a little bit of new jargon that they've added, such as establishing a rules-based system, dispute resolution, increased consumer choice, efficiency, and promoting good government. But the core of the argument remains the same. As I mentioned at the beginning of this session, we're constantly told that globalization is natural, inevitable, evolutionary even. Of course, that's not consistent with any definition of nature that I've ever found. The WTO and the other free trade agreements are documents. The WTO is a 550-page document. It took 7 years to negotiate, to write that document. It was written by a particular set of people with a particular set of interests. These were non-democratically elected appointees of the most powerful countries in the world, spearheaded by the United States. 500 multinational corporations had security clearances to participate in writing the document. No citizens' organizations, no labor organizations, no environmental organizations, no human rights organizations, no consumer product advocate organizations, no organizations working on the rights of children or other things like that. So we know who wrote it, and we know whose interest it was written in. What is it? What does it say? What does it do? Why does it matter? Essentially, the WTO is a new international constitution, and they even call it that. Renato Ruggiero, a former director general of the WTO, said, "We are writing the constitution of a single global economy." But this constitution is actually more powerful than any existing nation's constitution. It's more powerful than United Nations resolutions, It's more powerful than the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights. And in fact, the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, which is over 50 years old now, has no enforcement powers, while the WTO has all kinds of enforcement powers. The WTO, in fact, has a bureaucracy of hundreds of employees who enforce it. And what does it mean to have an international constitution? Well, it really works very similarly to how the US Constitution works, which is supposedly that any law passed within the jurisdiction of the United States, whether that's a local law, a state law, or a federal law, any law passed within its jurisdiction can be tested against the Constitution. And if it is seen to violate the Constitution, that law is illegal in the United States. And the arbiter of these questions of constitutionality is the Supreme Court. The WTO works exactly the same way. All of the countries that have signed the WTO agreement have thereby agreed to bring all existing law into line with that constitution, and also to not pass any new law that will violate the constitution. And if there are any questions about the legality, the constitutionality of any laws, those questions are to be decided by something called the Dispute Resolution Board of the WTO. Since we have a new international constitution and we are beholden to bring all existing law and all future law in line with it, we might want to be interested in what does it say? Well, it says, basically, that free trade, otherwise known as the right to do business, is the highest possible right. So this means that the right of corporations to do business, however they define what good business is the highest law over human rights, international labor conventions passed by the ILO, state and local law. It's a higher law than the right of governments to regulate, the right of citizens to assert a law that they want. Here are some examples of how it is that the WTO works, and there are some really important insights in these examples. One of the basic areas that it governs is the whole issue of tariffs and subsidies. A great example of what this means is the example of Mexico. Corn is an essential product in the Mexican economy, and the production of corn also has great cultural and social significance. Corn is produced largely by small-scale producers, many of whom are indigenous, and it's a basic foodstuff for Mexican consumers. Under the NAFTA agreement, Mexico was required to cancel any protective tariffs that they have on corn. What Mexico's corn tariffs did are what many nations' tariffs do, which is that they are an economic policy that ensures that domestic producers of that good will be protected from foreign competition to sell the same good in the Mexican market. So foreign corn producers were welcome to do business in the Mexican market, but the tariff regime made sure that they could not undercut Mexican producers. They could not undercut the price of Mexican producers. And so the tariff regime was set up that way, and that's how tariffs are set up in many countries to protect domestic production. So what happens when Mexico, under NAFTA's rules, has to eliminate regulations like tariffs that interfere with corporations that want to do business in their markets is that American corn now goes into Mexico and is sold 20% below the price of production. That's below anybody's price of production. It's not that American farmers are more efficient than Mexican farmers. It's that American farmers are so heavily subsidized, and American producers are in a situation where they have very few wholesaler, like middlemen, to sell to, so that those middlemen can actually drive down the price that they give to American farmers as well. So American corn is sold in Mexico even below the price of production in the US. That means that Mexican farmers have to reduce their prices to compete with American corn, and they've lost 50% of the price of their corn. That's not even enough. They can't even make it. And this is forcing farmers who have to leave their land and go look for a job in the tourist industry or go work in a maquiladora or immigrate to the United States and look for work across a very dangerous border. And tariffs are being taken away on many products. part of the hang-up in the WTO negotiations right now is that many of the Global South countries have, in fact, reduced their tariffs. The problem is, and they've obeyed that, but the products that are coming in to compete with their domestic production are often, as in the case of U.S. corn, subsidized in one way or another. Those subsidies are also illegal at the WTO. But interestingly, when the powerful countries are challenged about their subsidies, they just rename them. And so there's this huge struggle going on right now. So the Global South countries obey the rules, reduce the tariffs, but the more powerful countries, the Global North countries, don't play by the same rules. They don't eliminate their subsidies. And this results in incredibly devastating effects on small producers of various products all over the world. So those are called tariff barriers to trade. Then there are a whole bunch of non-tariff barriers to trade. These are our laws about product safety. These are our laws about, you know, health regulations to do with food. These are our environmental laws. These are our labor laws. These are all now non-tariff barriers to trade. Basically, anything that makes it more expensive or inconvenient for corporations to sell products that they want to sell, those things, if they're, you know, those regulatory instruments that might make things more expensive in the interests of public safety and health, all of those things are non-tariff barriers to trade. So here are some examples of non-tariff barriers to trade. The European Union used to have a ban on beef grown with growth hormones. This ban was established in 1980. And it was based on European science, which is slightly more independent of corporate funding than US science. Europeans like their own scientists, and their scientists had concluded that, in fact, there was a carcinogenic and possibly other health impacts of using hormones in beef production. And so this ban, a well-established, taken-for-granted ban. In 1997, the Dispute Resolution Board of the WTO heard a case which was brought by the U.S. trade representative on behalf of the U.S. cattle industry, in which they challenged the EU's ban, saying that this ban was a barrier to trade. It was preventing the U.S. beef industry from doing business in the European market. And the Dispute Resolution Board ruled that, in fact, the EU's ban was not based on sound science. Now, how could they say this? They could say this because in the WTO Constitution, science is defined. And science is defined as those standards set by, in the case of food, Codex Alimentarius, which is a corporate-dominated standard-setting body, which also thinks that Folpet, an agricultural chemical that's been banned in the U.S. for a very long time, is perfectly safe. The current standards of Codex Alimentarius are much lower than current U.S. standards in many areas of food safety and chemicals that are used on food. The science that the EU was referring to was not consistent with the Codex Alimentarius science, and therefore the WTO was not accountable in any way to this other science. They ruled against Europe's food safety law, and they have, in fact, ruled against every regulation that they have heard that is any kind of regulation to protect food safety, product safety, environmental law, or labor law. They've consistently ruled against everything that they've heard on those subjects. And now here comes the enforcement powers that the WTO has that most other international treaties and agreements that we, you know, sound good, don't have, like the, you know, International Labor Organization Labor Conventions or the International Declaration on Human Rights. After the ruling, the Dispute Resolution Board said to the trade representative of the European Union, you must change your law. And so the European Union removed the ban on hormone-grown beef. But European citizens are much feistier than US citizens, and they don't like it when their laws are changed, particularly laws to do with food. And so there was quite an uproar in Europe about these issues, and so a new law was passed requiring labeling saying the country of origin of beef, because then consumers would have their much vaunted globalization-given right to choice in the global market, and they would get to choose to not buy American beef, knowing that European farmers already had not been using hormones to grow beef because they weren't able to sell it in Europe with it, and they would be able to not choose American beef. Well, the U.S. cattle industry has the U.S. trade representative take the EU trade representative back to court And this time they claim that the new labeling law is discriminating against them in the market. They've appropriated the language of civil rights to talk about business plans now. And once again, the Dispute Resolution Board rules against Europe. And this time, the EU decides that they will not change their law. And so what then happens is that the WTO gives the US the power to put retaliatory tariffs of up to 100%, which would double the price, of EU products in order to recover the $117 million a year that the cattle industry says it's losing by not being able to sell in the European market. So non-tariff barriers to trade are laws, are regulations that protect us and the environment. And these are being challenged steadily at the WTO, and as well, as I mentioned before, new ones can't be passed. 80% of current US environmental law is subject to challenge under these rules. Our ban on carcinogens in food is subject to challenge. The European Union used to have a very nice law that required computers to be recyclable. That's gone. Now, there are a few other examples of how the WTO works. Here's a few more that I'm going to hit. And listen carefully to this one because it should ring a bell with something I talked about earlier. In India, it used to be the case that people's cooking oil was pressed in a small-scale, sustainable pressing technology owned by usually a woman, what is called now a micro-enterprise, meaning there's only one employee and that's the owner. And this pressing of the oil was done locally, and often it was done using the oil seed that had been grown by the person who needed the oil, or maybe they traded and bought the oil seed from a neighbor, and then they took it in some kind of container, like a gourd or a used plastic bucket or something, with them to see the oil pressing lady, and they got their oil pressed and took it home. Well, under pressure from the WTO, the Indian government passed a new law which requires cooking oil to be sanitized and packaged. And this is to bring India's law into conformity with the sanitary and phytosanitary agreement of the WTO. Now, on first examination, many of us might say, oh, sanitary is good. This is an improvement for India. But the reality is that the micro-enterprise women could never afford a packaging machine, nor a sanitation machine. And the result is that millions of micro-enterprises, women-owned micro-enterprises in this case, are put out of business, and one or two multinational food companies, which are really some of them cigarette companies, scoop up the Indian market for cooking oil in one go. And this might remind you of the way that the British Empire passed laws prohibiting people from producing their own cloth so that the British companies could be the ones to sell the cloth and make that money and therefore take over that market. This situation with the cooking oil is so similar in terms of external forces changing the laws in ways that enable them to take over the market for a product in India. That similarity causes people to describe free trade agreements as recolonization. Another example of what the WTO does is that many, many countries have grave concerns about the impact of biotechnology on the environment, on traditional agricultural varieties, but also on wild agricultural varieties. There's a lot of problems with biotechnology, ranging from human health to environmental impacts. And one of the particular areas of concern is horizontal and vertical gene transfer, and there's indication that both occur. Because of these concerns, most countries actually have some kind of regulation on biotechnology, seed, and foodstuffs. From 1996 to 2000, scientists and some politicians from around the world worked to articulate the Cartagena Protocol on Biosafety, which was an international framework to protect natural diversity from the potential risks of biotechnology organisms. And the protocol created this protection by invoking a piece of law that is commonplace, not only in international law, but in much of our national and local law, which is the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle, again, standard piece of law regarding marketing of products, says you cannot bring a product to market until you can prove that it's safe. The protocol also had, in the international framework, allowed countries to require advance information about any transport of biotechnology. So it was a pretty good protocol that these scientists worked out, but they lost on the most important paragraph, which is the paragraph that stated whether the protocol would be subservient to the WTO, whether it would be under the rule of the WTO. And because the WTO does not allow use of the precautionary principle, and therefore the biosafety protocol is completely toothless, and all of the energy that was spent writing it is worthless at this point because it can't be enforced against the WTO. The WTO's view of correct precautions is that in order to ban something, it has to be proven to be unsafe, which is something that our governments no longer have the resources to do, particularly in a WTO-mandated timely manner, which is very quickly. So companies now have the right to bring any product to market unless and until the government can prove that it's dangerous, which is much harder for them to do that and to do it quickly, particularly when the scientific establishment is more and more like in the service of the corporations. Another example of how the WTO works is called by the third world bullying. In the late 1970s, it was discovered by some health workers that Nestle, a company that does not only make chocolate bars but also makes infant formula, was using some very misleading advertising practices in Africa. They would send women dressed as nurses into villages and basically tell the women, the mothers, that infant formula was healthier for their babies than breast milk. And fairly quickly after this was noticed, that this was going on, the World Health Organization was able to document really high level of infant mortality correlated with the use of infant formula. And there are a few reasons why this happens. One is that poor women may stretch the formula too long, and so they're actually malnourishing their babies. A second reason that it's a problem is because often the water used to mix with the formula is not clean, and so it's causing illnesses in the babies. And the third reason is that breast milk actually contains all kinds of immunizations to local diseases, and if the babies don't get it, then they're more vulnerable. So the World Health Organization now has a recommended practice of exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months. And along with this recognition, all the way back in 1981, 118 countries signed a marketing code restricting the ways that infant formula could be advertised, with a particular concern to illiterate mothers who would be given the impression by any image of a very healthy baby being associated with infant formula that infant formula would make their babies more fatter and healthier. Guatemala was one of the countries that has laws governing the marketing of infant formula. One day they get a call, the Guatemalan trade representative gets a, or possibly it was the, I don't know if it was the trade representative, it was maybe a different agency of the government. Anyway, Gerber Baby Foods made a phone call, and they said, you know, we really like our picture of the healthy baby, but we really like the picture of this, like, our trademark baby. And we want to use our trademark baby to advertise in your country, and we understand you have these advertising restriction laws for infant formula. We think that you're appropriating our trademark by not allowing us to use it. If you don't allow us to use this imagery, we're going to take you to court at the World Trade Organization. Well, Guatemala defending their advertising code at the World Trade Organization would take 2 years and a team of lawyers and tremendous resources to go up against Gerber, which is a, you know, powerful, well-resourced organization. And so Guatemala had to just change their law and allow Gerber to violate it, or allow Gerber to violate the law. This kind of process, we don't know how many phone calls like that have been made and how many good laws have been changed as a result. And this dynamic is what post-colonial observers call bullying. In addition, many post-colonial constitutions are getting rewritten. This is called technical cooperation, and what it often means is the elimination of all kinds of really progressive laws, like land reform laws, like any kind of public ownership of resources, And the WTO describes this process of bringing constitutions into conformity as, they describe it as adjusting to WTO rules and disciplines, implementing obligations, and exercising the rights of membership. But from a third world perspective, of course, it's an incredible violation of the sovereignty that people struggled so hard for in the anti-colonial resistance. Now, you're probably thinking, this is monstrous. How did it get passed? And there's some evidence that the legislatures of many of the nations that signed this agreement were not aware of the implications for national sovereignty. And definitely in the U.S., we have a profound problem of people and our representatives and our congressmen really kind of delegating issues of economics to the experts, believing that they understand it better and we should really do what they say, and not realizing that the economy and economic decisions are quite political decisions and that they have a very direct impact on our own lives and we need to understand them. In the U.S., there wasn't a single public hearing ever held on the issue of the WTO, of signing the WTO agreement. I believe there's a funny story that Ralph Nader actually offered $10,000 to any congressman who would come to a press conference, sign an affidavit that he had read the WTO agreement, and answer 10 simple questions about it to prove that he had read it. And the $10,000 was going to go to the charity of choice of this person. Only one of our congresspeople came forward to accept this challenge. And it was Hank Brown. He was a Colorado Republican. And he said, yeah, I found that paragraph that we would have to give up all of our national sovereignty. And so he then said, I'm going to vote against it now. But there were obviously not a lot of congressmen who even felt the need to read it or felt it was their responsibility to even sort of test it against, do their own test of to what extent it was consistent with American democracy. They tend to follow the recommendations of the trade advisors, not perhaps fully acknowledging whose interests the trade advisors represent. Those people who are trained as trade lawyers, like the folks who serve as our trade rep, and also the people who sit on the dispute resolution board, they're lawyers usually who are trained only in one piece of the law. They're only trained in trade law. They're not trained in what happens when trade law bumps up against human rights law. They're not trained in that. They're only trained in interpreting trade law. And these are the kind of people who are then giving advice and interpretation to the politicians who have to make these choices. So this international constitution directly violates all kinds of other better, more democratic, more inclusively created pieces of international law. And that's one thing we need to think about in trying to figure out and trying to analyze the WTO's claims to be democratic. Well, if they're democratic, how come their democratic process violates other longer democratic processes that have been going on under the auspices of the United Nations and at the Rio Earth Summit and many other important international processes? One of the things that people sometimes say about free trade agreements is we can't really prejudge them. We haven't really seen them in action for very long. And in fact, the WTO is quite young. It's only 5 years old. It's still working out the kinks. And the best way to kind of think about that claim is to look at the fact that the free trade agreements are almost exactly the same thing as structural adjustment programs, which have been implemented in the Global South for 25 years and are an abject, frightening, destructive failure, described by Jubilee South as debt slavery and genocidal policies. So we do know what free trade agreements will do. We do have a historical record to look at for that. That historical record says that inequality has been increasing steadily for the last 20 years, regardless of which of the many economic measures of inequality that you use. This system, privatization, modernization, capital mobility, a race to the bottom, is not delivering on its promises. Even if we look at the places where there has been the appearance of growth, where there has been a high level of foreign direct investment, where we do see the symbols of modernity, even in those places that seem to be the more successful examples, in those places also, the inequality has gotten worse. And not only has inequality gotten worse, the gap between the rich and the poor, but the rate of absolute poverty has not been alleviated. So that's the historical record of these policies. And now we come to the fourth phase, historical phase of globalization, which is the incredible international movement of people who are saying another world is possible. Proponents of globalization say, Tina, there is no alternative. Opponents say, Tata, there are thousands of alternatives. Or in South Africa, they say, Temba, there must be an alternative. This fourth phase of globalization is called many names. Some people call it globalization from below. Other people call it people's globalization. Sometimes it's called anti-globalization. And an emerging term, which I am a fan of, is alter-globalization, because it implies a clear counter to the existing form of globalization. And it also refers to our alternatives that we have ready to go. One of the common misconceptions of the movement is that people are against something, but they don't know what they're for. And this has never been true about the alter-globalization movement. The most huge example of how not true it is something called the World Social Forum, which is a massive, democratic, participatory, open forum for people to get together every year to discuss their analyses and their alternatives to globalization. And the first year that the World Social Forum was held, something like 10,000 people went. And then last year, 200,000 people went. And now it's actually it's changing form into regional social fora in many parts of the world. And then there will still be the international ones, but there are going to be a little bit less often. One more example of the creativity and a model, incredible model of democracy of the movement is that we now have our own media. And it's maybe one of the biggest accomplishments so far of the alter-globalization movement is the creation of www.indymedia, that's I-N-D-Y, media.org, which is a model of how people all around the world can participate and govern democratically and be the media. The way it works is that anybody can post news to the newswire, and then democratic collectives edit it based on what people seem to be interested in and create feature stories from there. And at the same time as there's this democratic filtering up process through indie media, there's also generation through the indie media structure of autonomous media nodes in over 30 countries, and I don't even know how many cities now, over 100 cities have their own local indie media to cover the important events from the perspective of the people who are most affected, and with an emphasis on movements in resistance. And probably the best place to start keeping up with all of the amazing local and national and international manifestations of this fourth phase of globalization, which is people really confidently realizing that we can manage our own lives and create our own institutions that we need to communicate, which is not something that globalization gave us, something we already had. So quickly, here are some of the important historical, like sort of a brief history of the movement's emergence. By the mid-1980s, what came to be called IMF riots were already common across the Third World, the countries where structural adjustment was being implemented. Millions of people went into the streets, held general strikes, confiscated food and other basic needs in protest of structural adjustment programs. These insurrections have been cataloged by the World Development Movement in a series of reports called States of Unrest that are available online. And it's good to read those because it really helps to ground us in the knowledge of who is affected by globalization, how they understand what is happening to them, and what kind of resistance makes sense in that context. The movement against the IMF came to the First World in 1988 when 100,000 people protested IMF meetings in Berlin. And if you look at the photographs of those protests, it's very similar to what we see happening in the streets now in terms of how people look, in terms of the structure. So it really gives a sense of like a recent history of this movement and of the clear connections between Europe and North America. In 1992, the Uwa people, an indigenous group in Colombia, decided that they would not permit Occidental Petroleum to drill in their homeland. 10 years later, Occidental Petroleum actually withdrew. The Uwa had threatened collective suicide. They had said, "We are guardians of this land. Our culture cannot exist if there is oil exploitation of this land. And since we cannot survive, we're putting that on the table for not only Occidental Petroleum and the Colombian government, but the people of the world. What this really means for us is that we will be gone." On January 1st of 1994, the day that NAFTA went into effect, the Zapatista National Liberation Army appeared, saying they are trying to turn Mexico into a shopping mall. The Zapatistas were an armed group. They took over several towns and asserted their sovereignty in the face of free trade agreements and the accompanying corporate projects that were happening in Chiapas, Mexico. They have become one of the leading visionary voices of the movement, articulating not only the urgency of resistance, but also many of the methods of resistance and really modeling alternatives for people. And many people from all over the world have gone to Chiapas to visit with the Zapatistas and to see how they are creating alternatives there. You know, the army part of it is only a small part of what the Zapatistas do. In 1995, Ken Saro Wiwa, an activist with the Ogoni people and who had been fighting the oil exploitation of Ogoni land for 40 years, was executed by the state of Nigeria, and oil companies acted as part of the prosecution. Ken Saro Wiwa and there were eight other activists who were also tried and convicted and executed at the same time. But Ken Saro Wiwa was the most visible of these. He was the most famous. And he was really the first martyr to gain international attention specifically for struggling against corporations. In the early 90s, African religious leaders started to create a faith-based analysis and response to the debt crisis. And they started to use the religious interpretations of debt as a way of delegitimizing it internationally and challenging it. They quickly linked up with what became the Jubilee Movement, the International Jubilee Movement, which used the Old Testament idea of the Day of Jubilee when the slaves are set free and the debts are forgiven as a basis for having a vision that the debt would actually get canceled in the year 2000. And this movement spread across Europe, came to the U.S. in 1997, and in 98, in May, when the G8, the eight most financially powerful countries, had their meeting in Birmingham, England, 70,000 people made a human chain to break the chains of debt around the meeting. This movement for debt cancellation has a lot of solidarity happening in the global north, but consistent with the rest of the alter-globalization movement, the real force, not only in terms of intensity of actions and impact, but also the intellectual force, the defining political frameworks, come from the Global South. Two really important documents about the movement are the South-South Summit from Gauteng, South Africa, and the Dakar Declaration, both of which are statements about the debt and the kind of political frames that are generated by these Global South analyses are don't owe, won't pay. The debt has already been paid many times over through slavery and colonialism. They use the concept of odious debt, debt slavery, and debt bondage. I mentioned May 98. May 98 is an important month. In May 98, a few days after the Birmingham meeting, the WTO had a ministerial meeting in Geneva. And this meeting was the occasion for the first global day of action against the WTO. 10,000 people protested in Geneva, and people protested in many other countries around the world, and there was a linking up of these struggles, all against the WTO or against forms of free trade agreements and structural adjustment agreements that were more locally relevant so that people protested against those but explicitly linked up about it. So May 98 was the first global day of action. June 99 was the second. June 18th, the second global carnival of resistance or carnival against capital occurred simultaneously in 43 countries. And then in November 99 was the third global day of action on the occasion of the WTO meetings in Seattle. And this is the one that's best known. And you know, we need to understand why it's the best known and what exactly was its significance. It certainly was not the beginning of a movement. The movement was well underway. It also wasn't the first global day of action, as I mentioned, it was actually the third. What was significant about Seattle was that the US, people who are supposedly the beneficiaries of these agreements, made a visible, powerful statement to the rest of the world that we were suffering too and that we were against those agreements as well. And that act of solidarity was very meaningful and encouraging to the rest of the world and was in fact greeted with celebration all over the world. What happened in Seattle was that we said that if the WTO was going to be as undemocratic as it was, then we really couldn't allow them to meet. And unless it became democratic and they let all of the concerned people who had come to Seattle to greet the WTO, unless they were going to let us all into the meetings, then no one was going to go in. And so we actually stood arm in arm, blockading around the entire conference center and didn't let the delegates into the meetings. And then some of them talked with us during the day, which was slightly more democratic, but not enough. You know, this was a really great example of one of the growing recognitions of people around the world, which has become particularly poignant in Argentina, is that our democratic structures that we have in the US, our representative democracy and Congress and all of that, like, isn't working, it isn't functioning. And therefore, if we want democracy, we're having to be creative and figure out how to express democracy, enact democracy, make democracy real when the formal structures that exist aren't working. And so the use of the streets, which has been a classic location, one of the only locations where poor people have any power, is a form of democratization, creative democratic practice. And people regularly talk about the idea of like creating new spaces and the need to take direct action in order to create democracy in a context like these meetings going on. In Argentina, in December 2001, after yet another devastating structural adjustment implementation, people refused further structural adjustment, refused to allow their politicians to continue throughout a whole series of presidents, refused then an IMF bailout of the country, and are really doing this process of recreating democracy with the recognition that all of the elites, even the elites elected through by trade unions and elected by social movements, weren't able to be accountable to the people. And so they're implementing a much more direct form of democracy, where people who are unemployed, for example, block the road. They say there will be no economy until the economy recognizes us. So they don't allow goods to flow. And then when the governor of the city or the state agrees to negotiate with them or wants to get them off the road, they say, we're not going to the city. We're not going to send representatives to the city to negotiate with him. He has to come here and negotiate with all of us. And so they're creating a much stronger accountability than exists through the representative system. At the same time, people are creating democracy in their neighborhoods to meet basic needs. People are coming to their intersection near their house, gathering in what is called an asamblea, an assembly, and figuring out what are the problems and the needs in the community and how can people solve them. A lot of the banks have closed and people have very creatively turned the banks into community centers where there's political education and childcare and communal cooking and other things like that. Argentina has really become a powerful example that people are looking to now for alternatives, for creating new spaces, for being creative, for taking direct action, all of which are important hallmarks of the movement. A recent film called The Take documents how workers in Argentina are taking over the factories that the capitalists have abandoned, and they're running the factories themselves democratically, producing goods that are needed for use in Argentina. And they're really transforming not only the social relations of production, but people's sense of power and agency in their own lives. All of those forms of action are examples of what are called often the hallmarks of the movement. And these are democracy and not only democracy in a familiar way, but participatory democracy. and creativity and direct action, people who are worried about biotech crops being planted and potentially escaping into the environment are saying, we can't wait for the regulation. The regulation's not happening. And so they're uprooting, harvesting, midnight gardening the biotech crops in order to make sure that they don't spread. And in South Africa, where as water is privatized, prepay meters are put on people's houses. And when you run out of minutes, you run out of prepaid water, the meter turns off. People are taking direct action, organizing themselves to remove those meters so that the water won't be metered into people's houses. Then they deliver the meters to the local governor who allowed for the privatization of the system. These kinds of direct action are another important hallmark. And solidarity, Jubilee North and South are amazing examples and effective examples of solidarity. I mentioned Seattle. The Uwa people attracted huge solidarity from around the world, as did the people in India struggling against the Narmada Dam, which has now become another international issue with so much pressure applied that the World Bank actually ended up pulling out of that project, which is a great story to check out. On February 15th of 2003, 16 million people around the world said the world says no to war in the tradition of the Global Days of Action. And that tactic that happened in 2003, remember, it only started in 98, and now we have this incredibly powerful new tactic of solidarity. And then the last of the five hallmarks is autonomy and cultural survival and endogenous development, which again, the Zapatistas are great examples of showing us how we can build structures that are self-determined by our community that will meet our needs and our dreams as well.
You have been listening to the second and concluding part of Professor Amory Starr's History of Globalization. You can reach Professor Starr at www.trabal.org. That's TRABAL.org. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.